Good.
Welcome to this afternoon's chat session. I'm Bill O'Brien, and I'm here with Keith Lilly, as we've been a few times already, so. And we're here for today's live chat. And I just want to thank you all very, very much for tuning in. I know we have a number of our teachers, our enrolled teachers, but we have a number of folks that seem to be tuning in to these chats and participating in them, and we appreciate that very, very much. And I want to encourage you to use the chat room on our website, which is prismwv.org. And if you go to that, you'll get, obviously, live access to today's program, but more important than that, or as important as that, you'll get access to the chat room. Mm-hmm. And Margaret Ramsey is here, and if you have a comment or a question or something to add to the discussion, we would love to hear from you. Just enter it in the chat room, and we will get the information. We'll get it on as quickly as we can. I think we have some housekeeping issues to deal with first today, okay. Keith. So why don't you?
Well, I wanted to announce something that's not directly related to the PRISM project, but for Concord University, my friend and colleague in the history department, Jonathan Berkey, is one of the consultants in a new documentary on rivers here in southern West Virginia, and there's going to be an early preview of that video at Concord University in the main auditorium Wednesday at 5. And so this coming Wednesday we get a chance to see exactly what the documentary is about. And so he's not seen it either yet.
Oh, so he's going to be there.
He's
going to
be there. He's going to be there to answer questions, so he's interested to see what's going to be like when it's all said and done and the final version of the documentary. I also would like to remind our participants about the pretest, to send the pretest to Margaret when you finish it. We have received one, I do believe. I'm looking at Margaret. She's not looking at me. But one here up to this particular point. So if you could do that, that would be great. If you have lost the questions or something of that nature, please let us know so we can give you a copy of that. So that's coming up, and I do believe that will not be long until the first assignment in terms of the foreign policy course will be due as well. I'm trying to look for...
Well, while you do that...
That's the 18th of March.
Let me emphasize the importance of the pretest and the fact that you do it as soon as possible, because the very fact that it is a pretest means that we want you to take it before we cover the material, obviously, because we will take... You know, at the end of the course, we will do the post-test. And theoretically, there will have been a dramatic increase in what people know and understand and appreciate in American foreign policy after the fact. And so if you wait too long to do the pretest, then you lose the effect of the comparison between pretest and post-test.
So theoretically...
Pretest is significant.
So therefore, theoretically, if you watch this chat today... and you have not done the pretest, option A should not be something that you write on.
You should not take a question that we've already covered. That's a good point. Let me mention that as far as last semester's course on human rights is concerned, I have the pretests and I have the post-tests. And I also have a number of essays that enrolled teachers have submitted for the course. And they are sitting on incompletes, and I will change them all. I haven't done it yet, but please know that I've got them, and I will do them. There's been a number of teachers that have expressed an interest in getting the test back, and I don't really have a problem in returning the test for the course. As far as the pretest and the post-test, we can't do that, because one of the things that we are committed to is the idea of anonymity. And I don't even know whose tests they are, because most people didn't use their real names on them.
Exactly.
And so I wouldn't know who to send them to, which is exactly the way we intended it. Because what I'm doing in the annual performance reviews is basically saying that of the X number of teachers who took the pretest, the average grade was 65%. And then in the post-test, the average grade of the same teachers was, 92% or something like that.
Right.
And that's really the impact. That's what I'm looking for. And so those are kind of anonymous, and we're just going to keep those in the file. But As far as the essays that people have submitted on the questions related to this online graduate class, by all means, I'd be more than happy to return those. Let me, several of you, when I say several, three or four, folks have sent them in since I submitted grades at the end of the term. And knowing that they were coming, even when I got one, I just filed it away and waited till I got the rest. And now I think I have all of them. And so it's just a matter of sitting down and pulling them back up on the computer and printing them and reading them and making comments on them and then changing the grade. And I will do
that.
Which
is a fairly simple procedure, and the registrar at Concord has worked very well with us, I think.
Well, yeah, we're doing fine. One of the essays I got was from one of our teachers. I won't mention his name, but everybody knows who he is. And he basically sent an essay, an 11-page essay, with an apology, basically saying that if the essay is too long, it's my fault because he was in my history class when he went to Concord. Well, of course, that dates him quite a bit, as well as me. But basically what he's saying is, if this is too long, don't blame me, it's your fault. He usually writes pretty good stuff, so I'm looking forward to reading his essay. But we're in the midst of foreign policy. We will be doing three or four more of these chats this term between now and May. We're going to have Jeremy Surrey. We're going to try to get him in April, in the month of April, towards the end, because we really want to have him again on the whole issue of nation building and looking specifically at 20th century foreign policy, looking at Italy, at Iraq and Afghanistan, and looking at the first Iraq war, looking at Vietnam and Korea and those kinds of things, because they are all classic examples of what Jeremy Surrey writes in his book, which our teachers have copies of. So I'm going to be contacting, once we nail down a date, I'm going to be contacting Jeremy, see if we can get him on Skype, and we can do him on one of these chats.
Excellent. We also want to remind all of our participants about the need to schedule a visitation in your classroom, which will be, of course, part of the foreign policy course's evaluation. So it doesn't have to, again, be a particular session on a foreign policy issue or diplomatic history issue, but we do want to have a chance to come to your classroom and kind of see the kinds of things you're doing, the way that PRISM has impacted your classroom. And so if you haven't thought about that, please try to kind of think about it.
We only have a couple of months left.
Not much time.
We talked about it when the teachers were with us. So I think, we're not saying anything that they don't already know.
Right. But just as a reminder, I think that we definitely want to think about that. Even a reminder to us. Because I know that, like, once the session we had a few Saturdays ago was over, for a week or so, I really didn't think about it.
No,
I was going back to teaching and doing the things I was doing. And that's easy to do.
That's right. I'm doing the same thing.
Right.
I'm grading other papers and those kinds of things.
Precisely.
So, yeah.
All right.
Where were we the last time we were
interrupted. And in fact, I had to kind of ask a few questions. Did we cover this? Did we cover that? I do kind of want to pick up where we left off, maybe talk a little bit about the Monroe Doctrine. There is a question on the first exam, which again is due the 18th, about the Monroe Doctrine. And, of course, many of you looked at the Monroe Doctrine in the 19th century course. But the question is, compose an essay on the main points of the Monroe Doctrine. Discuss the origins and purpose of the policy statement. Some background research on the Holy Alliance might be useful. What importance would you place on the content of the Canning letter to Richard Rush? Endeavor to find other primary source materials to help you develop your interpretation. We're certainly going to look at that. And I also kind of want to dedicate some time today to thinking about diplomacy during the Civil War era, Union and Confederate diplomacy. And if we have the time, maybe we can talk a little bit about Reconstruction and work our way maybe into the ascent of the United States as a world power, especially in the 1880s and 1890s. Okay. It's kind of that's a lot.
Yeah, we can't do it. We won't do all that.
That's a lot, but that's kind of basically what I'm kind of thinking we might could talk about. But as we start here, and thinking about the Monroe Doctrine, which is certainly important for us because it will be a major cornerstone of American foreign policy for a very long time. Theodore Roosevelt will obviously enhance it to some degree with his corollary, which may at some point we'll talk about it. But the context here really builds on what we've been talking about.
Exactly.
What we've dealt with in the past two sessions has been diplomacy, American policy during the Revolutionary Era, and the immediate aftermath of the Revolution. And, of course, the United States, in its early form, was always susceptible to possibly being drawn into European conflicts. And that eventually did happen, right, in the War of 1812, which, again, generally American historians tend to see that as something separate. But European historians really envision the War of 1812 as being a theater of the Napoleonic Wars. Is very much related to the Napoleonic Wars. The British policymakers themselves certainly approached it that way. Mm-hmm. Since they were at war with Napoleon and they were at war with the United States, they thought of it in those terms. In the wake of the end of the War of 1812, and especially the defeat of Napoleon in 1815, obviously the victorious powers in Europe had a vision for what the world should look like. And, of course, they met together, obviously, at the Congress of Vienna, and I didn't bring it. I didn't bring all the books I thought about bringing today, but I brought it here, I think, one session earlier, but I didn't get a chance to talk about it. But any of you interested in the Congress of Vienna, just as kind of a background type of thing, or just happen to be interested in that event, the David King book that came out a few years ago, Vienna 1814, is an excellent narrative history that looks not only at policy, but also how social situations, even how the love affairs, the Duchess of Sagan had both the Metternich, the Austrian foreign minister, and the Tsar, Alexander the First, interested in her very deeply, and how all of that kind of impacted the jockeying of the various participants at the Vienna Congress. Of course, the United States is only tangentially interested there. They're not a power at the table. Yeah. They're not a power at the table. There's a big difference between that and what happens a century later, a little more than a century later, in Paris in the end of the First World War, in which Wilson actually is at the table. The United States is one of the great powers at that particular point. That's not true at Vienna by any stretch of the imagination. But those powers who got together at Vienna had a vision for the world. I mean, they do have some things that they agree on. I mean, they disagree on quite a bit. There's going to be quite a bit of grumbling and griping about who gets this province and who gets that province. And there's going to be plenty of tension between the various monarchs in terms of protocol and things of that ilk. But they do have some agreement in terms of what they envision in the world, which is so different than the Paris Peace Conference. Mm-hmm. The Paris Peace Conference, there really are two different ways of looking at international relations. Wilson just doesn't see things the same way that Clemenceau or Lloyd George sees things at that point. But back in 1814, 1815, Congress of Vienna meets before Napoleon leaves Elba. Mm-hmm. And then Napoleon, of course, retakes France. And then the Waterloo campaign culminates in June of 1815. Then the Congress of Vienna essentially is meeting again. But they agree on two principles. The world should be organized, or their world, I guess you should say, should be organized according to two principles. One would be a legitimacy. I mean, because, and this is kind of interesting considering one of the things that Jefferson says in one of our letters, one of our documents. The Congress of Vienna wants to restore legitimate monarchs wherever possible. Mm-hmm. Wherever possible. Restoration or legitimacy. When I teach the Congress of Vienna, I say 2 points. Whenever you can say 2 points or 3 points and build everything on two or three ideas, that's better than just going in there and giving a bunch of material. So restoration or legitimacy, and the other is balance of power. Right? So if Prussia gets this part of Silesia or Poland or what have you, then Russia should get this part. Mm-hmm. So they try to balance things out. And so they basically try to put the map back together again as a result. In fact, Henry Kissinger's book on the Congress of Vienna was entitled A World Restored.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, that's
right. That was the title of his book. And you can also get kind of a summary of some of his views on that particular event in his book Diplomacy, in which I think the first chapter is Richelieu, but he goes on, he does deal with Congress of Vienna considerably. And so those two principles are how they want to restore things. That has a lot of implications, actually, for the New World, though.
how this is the first instance of me being quiet, Bob. but how much of the Congress of Vienna focused on, I mean, obviously on Napoleon. I mean, obviously it was what Napoleon had been successful in doing that brought the conference together in the first place.
Right.
So what they want to do is restore Europe back to what it was before Napoleon.
Right. Well, as best as possible.
Yeah. How much of that effort to undo Napoleon went all the way back to undo Jefferson? In other words, to undo the American Revolution, the ideas of the founders.
And
the reason I'm saying that
is
this is a theme.
Yeah, that's important.
This is a theme because what it suggests, and that's what Gordon Wood makes this point in his book, on the Radicalism book, that if you really think about it, what the Congress of Vienna is saying, in a sense, is that the American Revolution is one of the most significant events that the world has ever experienced, because it basically gave rise to Napoleon, which in turn gives rise to the Congress of Vienna to try to squash it.
Exactly, yeah.
And so that's what we're really talking about here, is trying to reestablish the old order and to bring the changes that were instituted beginning in 1776 to an end.
Right. So, I mean, it is reactionary ideologically. Now, obviously, they cannot completely turn that clock back. I mean, for example, the Holy Roman Empire, which before Napoleon was almost 300 individual little polities, Napoleon had, you know, dramatically simplified it. You're never going to put that Humpty Dumpty back together again. It's too many pieces. And so there are going to be instances in which they're not going to be able to do that. But where it's possible, they will restore. You're going to put the Bourbons back in control in Spain. You're going to put the Bourbons back in control in Naples.
Right.
They're going to do that wherever it's possible. In fact, the Congress of Vienna probably does a fairly good job at dealing with some of those kinds of issues. In a sense, it does a good job dealing with the balance of power among themselves. But where they're problematic and where they really have a great difficulty is in dealing with the fact that the genie's been let out of the bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And that genie is obviously what the American and French revolutions had produced.
Right.
And that is a greater sense of liberalism.
Mm-hmm.
The idea, again, classical liberalism, the idea that people should have voice in government. The people that are meeting at Vienna are not liberals.
No.
And I'm not talking about
liberals and conservatives today.
Classical liberals are people that believe they should have some voice in government. Classical conservatives believe that Almighty God's decided that for us.
Right.
So the people at the Congress of Vienna, Metternich for Austria, Castlereagh, et cetera, for Britain, Talleyrand representing France. So France is there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's very unlike, Paris. France is at the table, but it's the restored Louis XVIII, right?
Yeah.
And so it's the restored monarch. So they are not liberals. They are conservatives. And so how do you deal with the ideological element actually is one of the things that will create problems among the victorious powers. I remember when we had Dave Bard, I think I mentioned this last time, when we had Dave Bard on last year, when we were talking about the Civil War and things of that nature, he made a statement that, industrialized warfare changes everything.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, the Napoleonic Wars was not industrialized. But it did change everything. And the reason why the wars of the French Revolution and Napoleon did that is they unleashed the ideology, right? The French Revolution took up so many things from the American Revolution and portrayed them in their own ways and presented that idea that people should have voice, presented that idea that we identify with the nation, liberalism and nationalism. And those forces, as they're unleashed, are a tremendous threat to a state like Austria. The Habsburgs, who are ruling over different kinds, very different ethnic groups. They're a multi-ethnic empire. Russia, who's trying to rule Russians, Lithuanians, Poles, etc.
Yeah, right.
Prussia. Most of these nations are not ruling just simply over one nationality. And so that creates problems. What if Germany is divided? What if Germany becomes one nation?
Mm-hmm.
How would that happen? What would that do to the policy of the Austrians, the policy of the Prussians? So all these ideological elements that the American Revolution helped so much to produce are something that the Congress of Vienna certainly had to address.
Mm-hmm.
And they really addressed that actually through the formulation of alliances, and in particular the one that usually people talk about is Holy Alliance.
How did they view the idea of the balance of power? You mentioned balance of power. they didn't mean every major power ought to have the same amount of power.
No, they
didn't mean real balance.
No, they did not.
They meant restore the world as it was before Napoleon, which meant the guys were in power then are still in power.
Well, also, they're trying to basically create a system that will prevent a general European conflict.
Right.
And in that, they're fairly successful. You have the Crimean War, which involves some of the European powers in the 1850s. You're, of course, going to have the wars of German and Italian unification. But they do prevent a general conflict in the sense of the Napoleonic Wars.
Do they look at the world, at Europe, in terms of balance of power, from a mercantilist point of view? In other words, what I'm thinking of is that the way Great Britain looked at the American colonies at the time of independence, where the colonies were there basically to generate and produce the wealth that the empire needed, and that ultimately the success of the empire basically meant that the empire became wealthier and wealthier, and that was a direct result of the colonies that it had. So in a sense, when they talk about balance of power, and this power would get this area and this power, they're almost talking about colonies. I mean, they're talking
in a way, spheres of influence.
And they're basically, what they're doing, it seems to me, is that they're reinforcing the idea that a major, even in the early 19th century, I mean, this is 1814, 1815, even then, they are basically acknowledging that the power of a nation is not defined within the nation itself, but it basically implies some sort of empire.
Yeah, but it also ignores, like, nationalism and nationalist fervor.
Exactly.
And which is something that Napoleon helped stir up.
Napoleon unleashed, Napoleon basically
made
nationalism a force.
We're going to sit there with maps, and we're going to basically carve out, you're going to get this, and I'm going to get that.
And I'm going to get that.
And so, we don't care about what the people in that area
believe. And that's the whole point of empire, of the imperial system, is that each player needs what we call a colony, but needs an area whose wealth and resources they can exploit, and whose existence as a market they can So it's already become a very commercial, expansive, competitive kind of world.
Exactly.
Economically, the reason I'm asking these questions is because at this time the United States, right after the War of 1812, we're kind of setting the background here for the Monroe Doctrine.
Right.
The United States wants to be a player in that game. They want to be at the table, but they don't want to be a player as one of the exploited. They'd rather be one of the exploiters.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, they want to be one of the major players with chips. And the Monroe Doctrine is I see the Monroe Doctrine as kind of a statement of the United States that we anticipate.
Yeah. We will be.
We expect to be a major player in this. We are no longer a colony of anybody else.
Exactly. Yeah. And I go a little further than that. I think that essentially the Monroe Doctrine is saying that this hemisphere, this is ours.
This is our playground.
This is where we will expand. This is where we will essentially create that empire that you're talking about. And that is a fundamental debate among historians about the history of the United States. Is the United States an empire? Does it have an imperial history or not? And I've noticed, I mean, I'm sure you have too, sometimes when you say to a class of college students, the United States has an imperial history, they immediately, they don't like that.
They type you. They
it's
basically
wrong.
Classify you based on that comment. Yeah.
They think it's wrong. And when I say that, I'm not saying that it's a good thing or a bad thing necessarily. I'm just, you know, we are expansionist from the very beginning.
We basically, I don't mean to get off the track here, but here I am. We, in some ways, educate our young people into the most naive worldview. That's why I think foreign policy is very important, because I don't think our people, our students in schools, ever get a real sense of what the world is like. And studies have shown over and over again that the American young, our education system, probably is turning out the most uninformed people about the world of any nation, any major nation in the world. We teach our young people that the United States is the only nation in the history of the world that conducts foreign policy for the benefit of everybody else, not us. You know, it's not. We're not selfish, and we go overboard in our mm-hmm. foreign policy yeah. to reinforce the Teller Amendment over and over again. The idea that our goals are not expansion, our goal is not empire. Right. We don't want to control everybody. We're in the freedom game. We want to bring freedom to everybody. And so the implication is that consequently students believe that. That's what they're taught. And so then when you say something like, you know, America's imperial history, people who believe that we're not imperial at all get really offended yeah. at this.
I like the idea but our expansionism is just such a, it's like a fact. I mean, we've expanded over the continent. I had a student once say, well, I guarantee the Cherokee would say that we were special, that we were imperialists.
Yeah.
Right? So, I mean, that's it's part and parcel of our past. But I think you're right in terms of very often, like, the terminology sometimes is used.
Yeah.
Balance of power. I mean, through most of the periods of American history, American statesmen have not liked the terms like balance of power, because it does have the connotations of a situation like the Congress of Vienna, in which things are being done without any reference to the people that they're being done.
That's right.
That whole concept of self-determination that Wilson right. emphasizes so much in the 14 points, but we'll see that even though he emphasizes it in the 14 points, that's not really what you get at the Paris Peace Conference.
No.
There's sometimes a conflict between ideology and interests.
Right.
And so sometimes I think we make our interests to conform to our ideology,
you know, the irony,
or vice versa.
In fact, you mentioned Wilson. One of the ironies that I see with Wilson is that Wilson is termed naive,
mm-hmm.
an unbelievably unrealistic idealist,
mm-hmm.
Because he goes to Versailles at the end of World War I with all of these visions of the way the world ought to be and the way, and he's a product, you know, and essentially, he believes what our kids are being taught.
Yeah.
He goes to, and the people, the nations, the other nations that are at Versailles, kind of look at Wilson like, man, where the hell, is he from another planet or what?
Yeah, you know, right.
I mean, Wilson is coming from so far out of left field that they don't even know
exactly
where he's coming from. I mean, he seems so unrealistic and so idealistic. And basically, Wilson believes the ideology. And therefore he's criticized as being very naive for that.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact of the matter is, so do most people walking the streets of America yeah. today.
Well, you know, of course, really getting ahead here, but I tell you, Kissinger also in diplomacy really kind of points to this. There is kind of a supreme contrast between Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson. Theodore Roosevelt is going to be the most European style statesman in our history. He's going to really adhere to the ideas of balance of power. Mm-hmm. He's a realpolitik. That's his basic approach. That makes him very unique in some ways. And he would be, of course, Wilson's most violent critic.
Yeah.
He would refer to Wilson's diplomacy as milk and water diplomacy. I mean, Bismarck could talk about blood and iron.
Yeah.
But he says milk and water. In other words, he's saying Wilson's, you know, living in fairyland or something.
Right.
He's not in the real world with the rest of us.
But
Wilson's
is,
prevailed.
Thing is, Wilson is basically living and breathing the ideology that it's been taught that we claim we stand for.
Right.
And the rest of the world looks at it and laughs at him, mm-hmm. effectively. I mean, it's so unrealistic. It's so unlike the way the world really is.
Yeah.
And what studies are showing today is that we're still turning out our young people out of our schools that way, and that we're turning out the most naive, uninformed people mm-hmm. about the real operations
right.
of the world. And one of the issues is balance of power, because
right.
our people tend to believe that balance means balance.
Yeah.
That, you know, in other words, when you...
Equity.
Equity.
It doesn't mean equity.
No. Everybody has the same amount of power.
No.
And that's not what it means at all. What it really means is stability. You know,
no,
what they're after is stability. They're
trying
to stabilize a world that Napoleon has totally disrupted.
So there is no way at the Congress of Vienna that France is going to get equity.
No.
I mean, it says something that they're there.
Yeah.
But especially after Napoleon comes back in 100 days, I mean, that really tied Talleyrand's hands.
Yeah.
I mean, Talleyrand was doing excellent. And in fact, if you look at what was taking place in Vienna, one thing that Talleyrand was doing, I mean, and we saw Talleyrand with the XYZ affair, but at Vienna, he is brilliant.
Yeah.
What he does is he basically tries to form a coalition of smaller nations.
Mm-hmm.
And tries to get them on France's side to try to make demands against the larger nations. And so is really making some progress for France until Napoleon, of course, alters that.
And look at talk about working with two strikes.
You better believe
Italy
it. Yeah.
Doesn't have. They're there in part because of what happened in France, and his guy representing France, and he's making demands.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing. It's kind of like Franklin at the peace conference at the end of the American Revolution. He didn't have anything. He's over there trying to sell ideas that these people don't want any part of. And Talleyrand is basically looking for France to be readmitted into the world of the major powers.
Right.
And he's doing very well.
He was a gifted statesman. But from the American point of view, we've already seen the impression of Talleyrand in the United States is someone who is unprincipled.
Yeah.
Right? He's unprincipled. There's quite a bit to that. But the fact of the matter is...
A lot of principle informed.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. You had to have someone who could who could play that game, and he could.
Machiavelli basically wrote the book on how to conduct foreign policy.
Yeah. But your statement about Wilson, I think, is interesting. I know we're going to get back to this, but in a sense, we can argue that Wilson really is more in the vein of the history of American foreign relations than Theodore Roosevelt, because... If you go back even into the colonial period to Winthrop, City on a Hill, the John Quincy Adams that we looked at, so many of these documents point to the idea that the United States is the example, American exceptionalism. And Wilson certainly plays into
He really does believe that. So in this, if you can't... Can you tell us exactly what the Monroe Doctrine says? I mean, what Monroe says in the Monroe Doctrine?
Okay, which is, by the way, just as much John Quincy Adams as him.
Yeah. He basically puts it together, and Monroe says it.
What comes out of this, and the reason why the Monroe Doctrine says what it says, Monroe Doctrine essentially says that European nations who have colonies in the Western Hemisphere, that's acceptable, but the United States will view any further attempts to colonize in the New World as hostile acts. And that comes, the reason why we're making that statement, it's just part of the annual address, that particular annual address, and it's probably written by Adams, who was Monroe's Secretary of State. But the reason why we can make that statement, the reason why we're making that statement is, of course, coming out of the Congress, Metternich is able to form an alliance with Austria, Prussia, and Russia. And the whole idea is they're trying to address that ideological problem. It's almost like they view revolution and liberalism and those things as disease. And when this disease pops up, we've got to get together and we've got to crush it, or we've got to destroy it. And so, in a sense, the Holy Alliance is kind of like a classical conservative collective security. Whenever a revolution, national revolution pops up, that's a threat to all of us. And so, therefore, we combine militarily, or we support each other, and we put it down. The problem is there is a desire, or at least a perceived desire, on the part of the alliance powers, and those three are the most conservative of all the powers, great powers, the prevailing powers, Austria, Prussia, Russia, to extend that to the New World. There has been a series of revolutions in Latin America, and the creation of new republics. And these new republics, obviously, are built upon the principles of the American and French revolutions.
Right.
And so, if you're thinking about those principles and the Congress principles in terms of restoring the world, they're a real affront to those principles, right? Because you do not have the proper dynasties, the legitimate dynasties in control. Also, you want to make sure that Spain retains some element of its greatness, France as well, in terms of their overseas empire. And so the fear is that they may try to find a way to kind of reimpose the old system back on parts of the New World. And England, as it turns out, Britain, as it turns out, is opposed to that. Mm-hmm. Now, the Monroe Doctrine says what it says. But it's nothing but paper unless it can be enforced. And I think one of the real interesting facets of this, until the 1880s, 1890s, the United States cannot enforce Monroe Doctrine.
We couldn't enforce anything?
No. You need naval power to do that. In the 1890s, we become a naval power. Steel-plated, steam-powered, capital battleships, we can do it, right? We can do it and then some. That's why Theodore Roosevelt's corollary is so impactful. He's saying that not only do you have to stay out, Europe, but if any of these particular nations here in America owe you money, we have the right to intervene to collect that money for you. You stay out, we'll take care of that. We will police this area. This is ours. We have the power to do it. We'll do that. And it's kind of a twist on that. But initially, the Monroe Doctrine actually is dependent upon the goodwill of Britain. And that's where that Canning to Rush letter comes in.
Yeah.
And won't go through every bit of it, but August 20th, 1823. And I think it's interesting. One of the things I was just kind of thinking about, Bill, it says right at the beginning of this, private and confidential.
Yeah.
But we know that Monroe read it, not surprising. But we also know Thomas Jefferson read it because he refers to it in his letter to Monroe. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't maybe quite as confidential as Canning thought it might be.
Yeah.
But Canning.
If it comes from Canning, it's open season.
But Canning, of course, is the British Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, and he's writing to the American minister, you don't have an ambassador-level diplomat yet, Richard Rush, and he's making a very interesting offer indeed. And he's trying to make this point to Rush before he leaves town. He's leaving London for some reason, wants Rush to think about it. He is concerned about whether Rush can negotiate. That's something we've been talking about. The United States was very reluctant to create the kinds of diplomatic structures that the European powers had. I mean, we didn't want to have an ambassador because an ambassador implied certain things. It implied a certain degree of expenditure in terms of entertainment, for example, for diplomatic functions and diplomatic balls and dinners and things of that nature. And the early United States viewed European diplomacy as being incredibly grandiose, repulsively so. I mean, the Congress of Vienna had, parties. I mean, the amount of money that the Austrian government spent, for balls. I mean, one of Beethoven's symphonies was premiered, at the Congress of Vienna. And they had
decadence,
exactly. And that is something that Americans viewed with a good deal of distaste. It wasn't a part of, American cultural outlook. And so also when Europeans came to Washington, they didn't see it as a plum appointment because it was drab.
We didn't treat them that way.
It was drab. You didn't have all the same kinds of, the kind of pomp and circumstance or soirees that you would experience in the Andrew Jackson administration wouldn't quite be up to snuff if you had been in Berlin, right?
Yeah. Defended our puritanical sensibilities.
Exactly. That's a great way of putting it, our puritanical sensibilities. And so we didn't have ambassadors, right? We had ministers. We're a little ways from that. I mean, that's something that's the 1890s. You start to have that, right? We start to kind of get in. We joined the club in the 1890s in a way.
But the reality is, while we reject the pomp and the circumstance, we reject the glitz.
Right.
We don't reject the principles on which that glitz is
founded.
We want to be a player.
Yeah.
And we,
but on our own terms.
And as far when we tell them to stay out of the Western Hemisphere, the implication there is that, just as balance of power is being redefined in Europe by who gets what we're saying is, when it comes to who gets what in the Western Hemisphere, we're the guy.
That's our decision.
It's ours.
You do what you want to do over there. In fact, there's the constant strain, from Washington's farewell address. You even find it in the letter we have, Jefferson to Monroe. We want to stay out of Europe's wars, right? We want to stay out of Europe's wars. We want to stay out of the entangling alliances. We do not want that particular... In a way, the United States in the wars of the French Revolution wanted their cake and eat it too. They wanted all the benefits. They wanted to be able to trade with both sides, and basically dictate how they wanted to trade to both sides. But when it comes right down to it, we want the benefits of that diplomacy, but we certainly reject what we perceive as being the decadence again of that diplomacy.
Yeah.
But Canning, comes up with five suggestions of what's going on here. And he's talking about those Spanish-American colonies. And he's saying, this is the British position. He lays it out really well. In fact, Canning could probably write a good History 102 essay. What do you think?
Yeah.
Make his case and build on it.
Yeah.
And
bam.
Show you here it is. This is why we should do it. You know, he doesn't just say we should do this. He tells us why. He explains. And he comes up with five things in the document. He says, we conceive that recovery of the colonies by Spain is hopeless. And it is a long shot.
Yeah.
Yeah, unless France... A recovering France would be willing to help Spain. That is possible, since you know you have Bourbon monarchies in both places. That is hopeless. He says we can see the question of recognition of those independent states to be one of time and circumstance. You know, if we haven't recognized them yet, we will. Right, time and circumstance. We are, however, by no means disposed to throw any impediment in the way of arrangement between them and the mother country. You know, we're not trying to interfere necessarily. You know, if they can work out an arrangement. The fact of the matter, and something is not stated here, is that Great Britain and British joint stock companies have found out that trading with these new republics could be very beneficial. Mm-hmm. You know, that they could really, really benefit from that. And also, I mean, in a sense, their empire does not have to be direct. Empire can be informal and indirect and sometimes be as profitable, if not more. Mm-hmm. If you can establish those kinds of trade relations and you're trading at an advantage, but yet you do not have the responsibility or expense of administration.
Right.
You know, from the British point of view, that's win-win.
So in effect, you don't have to physically own them.
Right.
But if they are so economically dependent on you, then effectively you do own them.
Yeah.
They have to basically. They can appear to be making their own independent decisions, but in effect you're making them because they have to run everything through you.
Exactly. So kind of informal empire. He says, you know, that they do not aim to possess them themselves. You know, we're not trying to take Cuba from Spain. That's not what we're interested in.
No. We want access.
We want access to
we
it.
We want access.
Right?
If the
Bourbons can reestablish their control over parts of Latin America and South America, the thing about formal empires, it excludes everybody else.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the whole purpose of having a formal colony. You gain the markets, you gain the raw materials, and your competitors do not.
That's right.
There's definitely an interest in seeing the independence of many of these places.
Could we,
Britain.
In purposes of trying to define, I've still got these ideas of liberal and conservative going around in my mind then.
Okay.
The way we're talking about.
Right.
Because most people who would be listening to us right now would think of liberal conservative in today's terms.
Yeah.
When, in a sense, could we, and I don't know, I just thought about this, but could we say that what we're talking about, conservative, is the old pre-trade, pre-commercial, pre-capitalist world of the aristocracy? Could we say that what the Congress of Vienna is really trying to do is reestablish a world that's no longer possible because of the balance of power and the idea of access, commercial access to all these areas suggest that business and economics and the rise of the middle class, the business communities in these countries, has reached a point where the old traditional landed nobility aristocracy that used to control these nations is no longer going to be allowed to do it. So in a sense, the Congress of Vienna I've always seen it as kind of an effort to try to hold on to the old in the face of a flood of what's coming, which is the new that they can't stop.
Yeah. I think you make a definite point. Also, you need to, especially if you consider the fact that they are monarchies. Now, Britain is somewhat exceptional in the sense that Britain is a limited constitutional monarchy. But if you look at Austria, Prussia, and Russia, they're absolutist monarchies. France, of course, will end up being somewhat of a limited constitutional monarchy. So they represent the principle of monarchy. But part and parcel of monarchy before the French Revolution, if you look at the old regime, was mercantilism. Mm-hmm. In essence, that the king's administration controlled the economy, orchestrated the economy.
Right.
Which business elements, especially by the 18th century, were really to oppose and reject.
Right.
And you can see, of course, the expression of that in Smith, right? In Adam Smith. And so, I think you're right. I think that economically the world was moving in a way that they didn't like. And so, and the proof, in hindsight, is the fact that you do eventually have revolutions that they can't control. The Congress system will break down. In 1830, there'll be revolution. There'll be revolution even in France. And in 1848, there's going to be revolutions almost everywhere,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so they can't address...
They can't stop it.
They can't address the problems of the future.
No.
Their answer is to work together, right? The Monroe Doctrine is one of the things that really, you know, really destroys the Holy Alliance.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't have an answer for it.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that, though, is because Britain has an interest in seeing this particular policy statement
right.
made. And so, I mean, it's an offer. I mean, it's not an alliance, right? It's not an alliance, but we're going to work together, right? We're going to do our best to, you know, to make sure, and of course, you know, Canning, probably aware of these, speaking to an American, talks about how, you know, essentially they have an opportunity, unlike any other peoples before them, to create a peaceful situation and things of that nature. So if you think about that document, and then you look at the Jefferson document that we have, in which Jefferson is giving advice to Monroe, and of course he refers to the Canning letter, so he's aware of that, and he sees a great opportunity. Somebody at Jefferson says, look at this, look what Jefferson says at the beginning of this letter, and he's writing to Monroe. And I would kind of recognize and think of this as a kind of a semi-official document.
Mm-hmm.
And he says this is, and I quote, the most momentous, most momentous question that has ever been offered to my contemplation since that of independence.
Mm-hmm.
This is very important, Jefferson is saying. And I think that Jefferson here understands that this is an opportunity. Britain is going to back us if we make such a statement.
Right.
Britain is going to help us enforce that statement to a large degree. And Jefferson shows in this letter to Monroe, and if you haven't read it as participants in our project or as anyone else who's listening to us, it's Thomas Jefferson to James Monroe, October 24th, 1823. And Thomas Jefferson tells us here in 1823 essentially how he envisions America as a power in the Western Hemisphere. And he realizes that the nation that is the most capable of inhibiting the United States in the Western Hemisphere is Britain.
Mm-hmm.
And so a chance to work with Britain is a chance that we shouldn't miss.
Right.
He, of course, criticizes the Holy Alliance. He compares him, in fact, to Napoleon. Right. He says essentially what they're trying to do is begun by Bonaparte, but now continued by the equally lawless alliance calling itself holy, right?
Yeah.
And so he's certainly ideologically opposed to that. In fact, he's even made a statement earlier that he's talking about Europe, and he's talking about the difference between Europe and America, and he says our first and fundamental maxim should be never to entangle ourselves in the broils of Europe. We need to stay out of their wars if at all possible. Our second, never to suffer Europe to intermeddle with cisatlantic affairs. America, North and South, so he's talking about the entire Western Hemisphere, has a set of interests distinct from that of Europe and peculiarly her own. It's interesting because he says she should therefore have a system of her own separate and apart from that of Europe. So the rules they come up with for Europe and how they're going to manage things in Europe and how they're going to divide things up and this power's going to get this in Europe and that power's going to get that in Europe should have nothing to do with us.
No.
Now, of course, ironically, or not ironically, who gets to speak for the Western Hemisphere? It's not Bolivia.
Yeah.
It's the United States, right?
Exactly.
It's the United States. So while the last, meaning Europe, is laboring to become the domicile of despotism, the French Revolution failed.
Yeah.
The powers of despotism had prevailed, right? Napoleon, as lawless as even Jefferson would take him to be, was at least someone who had lip service to the concept of liberalism, but these are the powers of despotism. So there's an fundamental ideological difference between how we envision the future of the Americas and how they would see the future of Europe. And so he contrasts the United States and Europe. And he says some things that are interesting. He talks about Cuba. He says, do we wish to acquire to our own confederacy any one or more of the Spanish provinces? He says, I candidly confess that I have ever looked on Cuba as the most interesting addition which we could ever be made to our system of states.
Oh yeah, Cuba's.
Yeah,
they've been looking to pluck.
They
that
love
one
that, right? John Quincy Adams would call it like a fruit.
Yeah,
it's like an apple. It's just not.
It's just hanging there, but it's not quite ripe yet.
Not quite ripe yet. Just pick it. You know, it's not quite ripe. Long before the Spanish-American War, obviously. So, you know, he envisions it are expanding, and this the Monroe Doctrine is good policy for us, and the fact that Britain comes in on it with us, that is excellent. And therefore, we should do this, right?
Because England has got the muscle that can make this whole thing
right.
work.
Right, exactly.
Britain is in a very interesting position here because I'm kind of going
That's
back
true.
To what I was saying
true.
Before. Because while the Congress of Vienna is trying to restore the whole issue of restoration, Britain has moved beyond that.
Their policy's changed.
They're not quite where we are yet. I mean, they haven't quite adopted the principles of liberalism as the Declaration of Independence defined them.
They're a lot closer than Prussia.
A lot closer than Prussia or the Bourbons or any of the Habsburgs or any of those other groups. And so, in a sense, Britain is basically looking toward the future. The whole idea of liberalism in this time is the Latin term freedom. And so, and freedom is capitalism. It's free enterprise. It's the freedom to buy and sell and work
exactly.
and save and all of this. And so what we're talking about here is the emergence of what's going to become free enterprise capitalism in the 19th century. Once industrialism happens, it's going to be industrial.
And that's not far from taking place.
And I've always looked at the revolutions that occur in France, the revolutions of 1848, for example, as kind of the reality of what Canning sees and what Jefferson sees hitting Europe. basically what happens is it's kind of like the it's a blowback
exactly
kind of thing. You know, they try to restore the old revolutions of 1848 indicate that's not going to happen,
right?
So then the next question is, how far do you go towards the new?
Yeah, of course, the revolution in France in 1830, which takes even place before the 1848, when Charles X, who was Louis XVIII's younger brother, he really tries to turn the clock back. I mean, divine right, absolutism, censoring the press. Even in his coronation, he lays hands on people who are crippled in order to use the divine power of the king to heal them. Something like medieval kings do this kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, doing that. Louis XIII, of course, you know, supposedly healed people during his reign. There's one particular instance of that recorded, but. The whole idea that, you know, he really tried to turn the clock back, and he gets, you know, of course, the revolution comes, and he leaves the country, and then, obviously, there's not enough change, and that produces 1848. Interesting, though, in Britain and the United States, and this kind of speaks to your point, in Britain and the United States, essentially, you do not have these kind of revolutionary movements. In Britain, of course, you have the Reform Bill of 1830, and there's a great letter from the Tsar, I think it was Nicholas I at this particular point, of Russia to the king of England, I guess it would be at that point George IV, right? And which, you know, he's saying Parliament had burned down, the building had burned down, and he's basically accusing the king of England, the Tsar is accusing the king of England, he's basically saying, God has judged you for allowing so many people to vote, right? God has judged you. That's the reason this is happening. That's not the way, that's not the order that God has established. But the Reform Bill of 1830 opens things up. Mm-hmm. You have more participation. What's happening in the United States in the 1820s and 1830s? You're dropping property qualifications in many of the states. Most of the new states that will come, all the new states that come into the Union between 1828 and the American Civil War, they do not have property qualifications, so you're moving toward an expansion of the franchise. I think you make a great point that the United States and Britain both were more in the vein of expanding that.
Right.
Sometimes I think, and that's why I try to, this is something that's sometimes hard to get across to students. A lot of times in a class, like an American history class, and of course we're here in southern West Virginia, and I say, okay, 200 years ago this would be part of Virginia. How many of us can vote? And I have everybody in the class have their hand raised up. Right? Everybody raise your hand. I get them all to raise their hand. And I said, yes. I get everybody raise your hand, right? And I said, well, first you have to be male. That gets the girls to lower their hands. Okay, everybody's not male. Hands go down. You have to be white. You have to be adult, which is 21 years of age. And by that point, you know, in like a class on the main campus, there may be three hands up, right? Yeah. Including my own. And then I say, you have to have 50 acres of property. And more often than not, no one in the whole room can actually vote in, you know, 1813 or whatever, right, in Virginia. But then I make the statement, and I definitely want them to remember this, that the United States is the most progressive nation on the face of the earth in 1813.
Sure.
It's the most inclusive around, mm-hmm, right? Especially when compared to Russia or the Ottoman Turkish Empire or something of that nature. And so, yes, Britain and the United States are kind of looking forward. It's not something that, you know, they're rushing headlong toward,
no,
right?
No.
But it is something that is the direction that they're moving.
They're trying to control a wave of change that, mm-hmm, they can see coming. And the rest of the European nations are trying,
right,
to stop it and restore the past.
Yeah, and of course, in the case of Britain, I think even more than the United States, there's definitely a division in terms of their politics, right? Conservatives, Tories, see the United States as a bad example.
Not to throw a kink in this at all, but to what extent did... I mean, we're talking early 19th century here,
yeah,
so obviously one of the realities in America is the division between North and South over the issue of slavery.
Right.
To what extent is that sectional difference between North and South
that's a
factor here? And what I mean is the slave system... if you listen to what John Quincy Adams, Monroe,
right,
is saying,
yeah,
and you look at what Canning is talking about, and you look at the future that they envision, slavery doesn't fit into that at all.
South's not aligned.
No, they are not in that at all.
Which, of course, is certainly a major factor when we get to thinking about the Civil War.
So the whole Southern strategy from throughout this point all the way up to 1860, mm-hmm, is to try to inhibit the implementation
expansion
of any of this.
Yeah, and the South does lag behind. Virginia and South Carolina especially. In terms of trying to eliminate property qualifications, Virginia doesn't do so until the 1850s. Popular election of officials such as governors. You do not have a popularly elected governor in Virginia until the 1850s. And that meant that the state legislature elects the governor, which means the governor is always an Eastern Virginian or the planter class, and all the implications of that.
It's very clear right now that Virginia is still interested in going back, that they've got, this has gone way too far.
Virginia's changing a lot. Of course,
yeah.
Of course, when we talk about Virginia today, there's such a huge difference from Northern Virginia,
yeah,
and Southwestern Virginia.
Yeah.
And you know, you get a lot of differences even within that state. But I think that's important, the ideological struggle going on in America. In a sense, the South does represent a different society.
And that was the point I wanted to make for people tuned in, is that the more you understand this, the more you begin to realize how this slave South is totally,
yeah,
out of context. It doesn't fit into this
right,
at all.
Well, I heard you once say that the South never ceased to be colonial.
No,
it didn't.
No,
it always was colonial. And I remember when we saw Gordon Wood a couple of years ago in Charleston for his lecture. In essence, he said that you know the South claims, and I think that if we look at and we might do that, we get the chance to look at Jefferson Davis's inaugural address.
Mm-hmm.
The South claimed that the North changed, but the South did not. That, in essence, you know, the agreement that they had entered into was one thing, and the North had altered their very character. There's a lot to that.
Right.
And, of course, Gordon Wood made that.
So
made
Davis
that point.
Is arguing that the South is much more in line with what the founders,
yeah,
intended than the North is. The North is the one that's gone haywire.
Well, yeah, I mean, the founders of the Confederacy would see themselves... As Davis says in his inaugural address, that the Confederate Constitution is the true meaning.
Mm-hmm.
It's the true meaning of the framers. It's the true meaning of the founders. That we are actually carrying on the traditions. The North have altered themselves in various ways. That whole market revolution has taken place in the North. It's certainly meaning a different economy, a different culture, etc. Of course, I think that the differences between North and South go all the way back in the colonial period.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, I mean, there are different ways of interpreting, obviously, the coming of the Civil War. And one of those predominant schools of thought is that whole idea of the irrepressible conflict. you know, that's almost an inevitable event because you have such differences between the sections. Henry Wilson is especially known in the late 19th century for that particular school of thought.
Right.
But you even have historians today, Eric Foner, others who basically adhere to that. And then there's, of course, also that blundering generation thesis, which I think has a lot of merit, too. I mean, the leadership, both North and South, in the decades before the Civil War, made, you know, crucial errors and crucial mistakes in misunderstanding each other and things of that nature. A lot of times I'll try to get students to take a position on which one's better. And what I want them to do is argue which one's better. And invariably they tell me, oh, both have great merits.
Yeah.
You know? But I'm trying to get them to take a position. Yeah. Please take a position.
Yeah.
I don't think that either one, I think both have merit as well, but take a position on one in your essay, please. Write about one or the other. It's so hard sometimes to get students to take a position on
Well, because you can
like
be
that.
Wrong.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but there's another side, and that's why it's a good argument. You know, was the Civil War inevitable?
I mean, you were talking about the irrepressible conflict idea, and you were talking about the blundering generation, and you were talking about these things. And one of the things that I've always been fascinated by is the inability of the two-party political system to hold the union together.
Exactly, that's blundering generation.
Yeah, and what really concerns me as a citizen is that I see this as a basic inherent weakness of our political system. Mm-hmm. The fact that our political system fell into the sectional divide and tried to turn it into political other than addressing it, rather than fixing it, they became part of the problem rather than part of the solution. And we're seeing that today. In terms of the dysfunction that's going on in Washington right now, what we're seeing is that our political system is becoming a reflection of the dysfunction of the society in general rather than the institution or the agency that fixes it and brings it all together and makes it good again.
Exactly, yeah.
And that's so it seems to me, it's always seemed to me, that the fact that the Civil War happened to me is a basic blatant statement as to why our political system can't govern.
Yeah.
It can govern in good times, but it can't govern in bad times.
It can't govern without compromise.
No.
And the point is, in the 1850s, compromise became harder and harder to accomplish.
Well, and that because more and more ideology enters into that.
That's
ideology,
true today.
The more ideology there is in there, the less compromise is possible. That's why Machiavelli had the best system in the world. There's no ideology involved. You just do whatever you need to do to win.
The ends justify the means. That's a good point. I think a lot of people, Bob, when he saw Lincoln, commented about all the parallels that he thought he could see between, you know, that era and this era. There's plenty.
Yeah.
There's plenty of that. You look like you have something to say.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Well, just a question. To what extent do you think that Jackson and the Removal Act, and to the extent to which it largely depopulated what was then deemed to be the Southwest, you know, the Alabama, the Mississippi, the West Georgia, West Tennessee, all of that, to the extent that it depopulated the native peoples, to what extent did that worsen the problem in terms of enabling slave culture and making the split broader between North and South?
It provided the slave system with area to expand, without a doubt. And if you see that in conjunction, obviously, with the cotton gin and the predominance of cotton, and of course, cotton's going to be by the Civil War, 70% of American exports is Southern cotton. So, I mean, that is one of the reasons why, and sometimes we really fail to see this, is, you know, Jackson's policy of Indian removal is something that he is rightfully damned for now, right? But it's something that at that particular time was very popular with many important constituents for him, especially with, you know, Georgians, et cetera. I mean, so I think it's very important in terms of the outcome of that. Also, I'll point out something else that's very important since you brought that up, and especially since one of the options for the teachers is basically to compose your own essay. I'll point out again, we mentioned this before, Herring sees relations with Indian nations as foreign policy.
Right.
As foreign policy.
Yeah. As a foreign policy.
It's foreign policy. John Quincy Adams would say yes. Andrew Jackson would say no. Right? Andrew Jackson did not treat it as foreign policy. Andrew Jackson, was pro-state, pro-settler, right, as far as his approach was concerned.
Our Indians.
Yeah, yeah. And so, I mean,
our red brothers.
at best, maybe portraying it in a sense of paternalism, right? So if you see a lot of the political cartoons from the time, you have all the little Indians on Jackson's knee, and he's the father, right? That kind of an image. I think I used one of those in one of the Prism sessions at one point. So that kind of approach. By the way, when you look at the cartoons in the 1890s that are relevant in terms of foreign policy, and the United States is thinking about taking the Philippines as a colony. Filipinos are little people. They're little people. They're children, and that is a part of imperialism as anything else. How did the British see their colonies? One of the problems of the American Revolutions. They're the fathers, they're the parents. The children are not listening to the parents.
Right.
And so it's you certainly have that part of it as well. And so that will be a major kind of a difference, I guess you might say. But Herring sees it in this book as foreign policy.
There's no way that Jackson and Zilk would even acknowledge that in dealing with the Indians, you were dealing in foreign policy. I mean, to make the assumption that in dealing with the Cherokee, you're basically doing the same thing as dealing with England.
And what is so ironic about that is if you study your Native American culture, they had such a sense of diplomacy and such a sense of how to conduct diplomacy and come up with agreements and persuasion and the use of wampum belts and a kind of a sense of the tactile writing, and here's the agreement and here's a statement we're going to make. And as we go to the conference, and one of the great sources, I think, for the colonial period are council fire speeches made by Native Americans. I mean, they're just tremendous as sources.
Well, where and when then does the idea, which we manifest now, of sovereignty in the Indian nations arise?
Oh, not really sure. I don't know if I can really put my finger exactly on that. Would you think it would be for the Dawes Act? Or I'm not exactly sure where we come up with that idea. But even then, the sovereignty today is not, certainly not an absolute sovereignty.
It's sovereignty, but it's second-class sovereignty.
Yeah,
it's not real sovereignty. It's not acknowledgement of equality by any stretch.
But I can't really put my finger on the watershed of it.
And it's kind of a fallback position because the whole idea of assimilation didn't work.
Right.
And that was the first one, is to make them disappear by assimilating them into the larger culture. Mm-hmm. And that didn't work. And so then what you do is you basically draw lines and you put them on reservations and you basically acknowledge their existence as a people, but you basically put a wall around them.
Until you want that land another time.
If they're not going to assimilate with us as individuals, we cannot deal with them as a people. Mm-hmm. We deal with them as individuals, or they remain separate as a people.
Right.
And that seems to be our approach.
I think his point about opening up land for the slave system is very important. Foreign policy does have a role in that sectional debate.
That's where we are right now. I mean, in this course, I think, because foreign policy, especially during this period, doesn't make any sense unless you consciously keep in mind the differences between North and South and the extent to which the South must find ways to expand slavery as an institution. And so the South's position in every foreign policy issue, the Mexican War, the independence of Texas, California, all of these things.
Compromise of 1850.
The South looks at them as the potential for more states. The acquisition of Cuba.
Right, yeah. The Austin Manifesto in the 1850s is obviously a Southern attempt to seize Cuba from Spain so they can divide it up into three or four states. Slavery already exists in Cuba under Spanish law, and so therefore it would be slave states. Anytime new states enter the Union, that's a controversy because that's that many free state or slave state senators obviously sitting in the United States Senate. And so you see it with the Austin Manifesto. I've got a comment here. Okay.
Going back to your risk-taking.
Oh, risk-taking, okay. Okay. My opinion is that students are rarely asked to take a risk in the classroom or in their assignments, except for kids who take debate. It is entirely a foreign concept. And this is a teacher who's listening to us from Texas. Here's someone else is responding to that teacher, right? Astrove, right? Responding to that teacher and said, yeah, I totally agree. I remember back in high school, in college, I hated being the guy who always talked and then had to hold back because I was the only one willing to share my opinion, right? So that's a good point.
We should note that Mr. Astrove is a preschool teacher.
Okay, so these are professional educators commenting to us here, right?
Yeah.
People who actually teach.
Yeah.
Just get up here and talk about history for a couple hours like we do.
And this idea of no risk, I mean, it's exactly right. That's why the way you avoid risk is you basically avoid taking a position.
Yeah.
I mean, you keep your mouth shut during class because the thing you have to be most careful of is being wrong. And the best way to not be wrong is to not even risk being wrong.
And then you're never right either.
To what extent do teachers, I mean, and this is more educational related, and probably Betsy who wrote that comment could address it as well.
Okay.
But, you know, teaching to the test is very obvious, obviously stark black and white, right and wrong. So to what extent does something like what's going on in PRISM challenge that notion? And how does it work into a testing scenario? I know Betsy's manifestly frustrated because she has no time in her... she's not allotted any time to teach this kind of stuff.
No.
So...
because it's a black and white... the whole education system is basically dealing in black and whites.
So
blacks and whites.
Once upon a time there was shut up and pass the class in terms of agreeing, that there was an obvious point of view being expressed by the instructor... So one would try to manifest that or achieve a good mark by agreeing with the way one was being taught.
Yeah.
Now it's a different kind of paradigm, isn't it? Where one has to agree with the test, and the teacher is merely a transmission vehicle for that.
And in a sense, the test is
the ultimate arbiter.
Yeah, is not just only the arbiter of the teacher or the students, but also the school, right?
It's the arbiter of what is right and wrong. For instance, in Texas, where Emil Schlafly now has greater historical prominence than Cesar Chavez.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, doesn't that filter down sort of almost in like the capstone of a pyramid to the base of the pyramid and become all inclusive in terms of rightness and wrongness as opposed to analysis and introspection? Does that make sense?
And also
the idea
of the blacks and whites of the test, one of the things that concerns me, Bob, is that we have, first of all, these tests are for the most part are put together by educators, in the generic sense. And what I mean is they are people who believe that the system, that the current system we have, if it's not working, it can work. And so they talk about things like discussion, like differences of opinion, like different ways of interpreting these things, like engaging a piece of history, whether it's a document or a painting or a map or it doesn't matter what it is, and drawing meaning from it. And our education system is focused primarily on bringing meaning to the sources rather than drawing meaning out of the sources. It's kind of like the way our foreign policy was being conducted. We were just talking about that in a sense we want to play the game that Europe is playing, but we don't want to play it in that language.
Right.
We don't want any of the pomp and circumstance because our ideology finds that whole thing repulsive.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to be able to maintain the position that we are not playing that game, but in reality we know we have to play it.
Mm-hmm. But to me, I mean, part of the problem, these tests that you're talking about, I'm assuming, are basically multiple choice tests, right?
Absolutely.
And multiple choice tests, I mean, it's the answer is right or wrong. That's
it.
There's no other way of looking at it. There's a big difference between that and studying history or doing history as we kind of think about it in the PRISM project, in a sense of trying to reconstruct or interpret events, trying to think in terms of cause and effect, thinking as opposed to basically trying to. It's important to, I think, learn content I mean, I tell my students, you cannot write an essay on something without content.
That's right.
And like I have an exam, I'll have more different sections in the exam, and one section, you know, is, you know, a completion section. Mm-hmm. And there's a direct correlation between the completion section and the essay section. If they can't answer essay completion questions on reconstruction, they cannot write an essay on reconstruction. They have no content.
Well,
right? But it's not content. It's what you do with content right. that's important.
The content is not the education. What you do with it is the education. And what, the point I was trying to make earlier, and I probably didn't make it very well, but when people talk about analysis and comparison and compare and contrasts and, mm-hmm. And ranking things and assigning importance to some things over other things and all of these things, in the education world, in the formal education world, those are concepts. Those are
right.
Those are strategies. They're intellectual strategies. But without content, they're meaningless.
Right, yeah.
And once you begin to apply them to real situations and real people, once you look at history and you actually try to put yourself into the position of the players in a particular mm-hmm. historical event, how would these people look at the situation? Mm-hmm. How would the United States look at what's happening at the Congress of Vienna in 1815,
exactly.
given where we are?
Right.
And so what we're saying basically is the United States came out of a whole ideological school. The idea of the participatory government, republican government, the right of the people to know what's going on, the right of the people to have access to information, the right of the people to speak freely and have a free press and practice religion however they wanted to practice it and all of those things. So we're coming out of that background, and at the same time, we're looking for entry and recognition and acceptance into a world which is still functioning in the old world.
Right, yeah.
And we need to be in that. We need to play that game, but we can't appear to be playing that game because we have this whole ideological...
With ourselves.
Otherwise, we appear to be hypocrites.
Right. Yeah.
Where we're saying one thing and doing something else. So in a sense, what we're trying to do is turn that game into something that's very consistent with where we are.
Okay.
And where I see England in this, and Canning, and this whole issue of the Monroe Doctrine, I see Britain during this period... as being kind of halfway between the two. They see where we are, and they see that where we are is where the world's going. So they don't want anything to do with that European past necessarily, right. because they see the future. We look at the situation and we see Britain's got everything to gain by our Monroe Doctrine.
Right. Yeah.
Therefore,
it's interest based.
We can depend on Britain's. Yeah. Military power to provide muscle to our Monroe Doctrine, and we don't even have to do it.
Yeah,
I mean it's brilliant. It's John Quincy Adams, it's brilliant.
Yeah, it's excellent statesmanship. There's no doubt about it. Got another comment here, and I think this is also from our teacher from Texas. And you know, before I read this, now I really feel for many of the people in our project, and for people who are teaching out there, in these contexts, we're college professors. And so we basically can cover whatever we want.
Yeah.
And we do, for the most part. And we don't have those restrictions and things like that. And I think it's hard for us to relate in many ways, and maybe hard for us to fully understand exactly what they experience.
I mean, the CSOs it's a drumbeat, and you got to march to them.
Yeah. Well, you don't have to. I cover what I want to cover. I cover what I'm interested in. I make a point with what I cover, but... I don't feel chained like that. I kind of wonder about that. I mean, the way we kind of are compelling, educators, to basically, toe the line on certain topics and things like that, maybe it helps explain some of the problems that we have on our level, in terms of, again, getting students to take positions. You had an essay question, I know, this past week in one of your classes in which you're asking your students to take a position or asking them to explain something. They're going to look at the world from the point of view of 1750 or something like that. And where would you go and who would you talk to?
And what they do is they say, go to him, he knows.
I'd send him to England.
Go to the Pope.
Why? But why is never really explained. And so she says, and I quote, I gave my fifth graders an opinion essay Friday, and one kid asked me if he was allowed to say no. I told him to go ahead as long as he can give three reasons for his disagreement. Best essay he has ever written. I like that, right? So he gave three reasons for why he disagreed. That's great. And I think that that's an excellent point. You have to be willing to let students take a position you might not necessarily agree with.
If you really want them to think, you have to surrender the right to control what they think.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the bottom line. You know, and we've never been able, as a system, as an educational system, we've never been willing to do that. We say we encourage people to think, but in reality, we constantly insist on making sure that we know what the end product is going to be. Mm. And as long as we control the end product, then it's not really thinking.
But can you measure?
It's disguised indoctrination.
But can you measure it? I mean, can you measure it with, you know, 50 multiple choice questions?
You can measure educational effectiveness providing there's no gray, providing right. There's right answers and wrong answers. Then what you can do is you can say the people that have the most right answers are the brightest, and mm-hmm. the people that have the fewest right answers are the slowest.
Yeah.
And that works. And that's the system that we've educated our teachers in. And we've done it at the expense of content. Mm. And so the fact of the matter is the teachers, our teachers, don't have the benefit of the engagement with content that would allow them to become so much more aware of the instructional options. And the irony is those options, engaging content like that, is not necessarily inconsistent with the CSOs. Mm-hmm. We're not asking people to go in a different direction from what their job requires them to do. What we're basically saying is you can find a whole new way to accomplish these things, and you won't believe what happens to children, to youngsters who are beginning to see. I mean, I think it's incredible that a child has to ask permission to say no.
Yeah, that is interesting.
Holy good Lord.
She also goes on.
And
to
I don't. That's not a criticism of of Texas, because it's the same here.
Does this reliance on standardized testing, to what extent does that reduce a teacher from being a professional to merely a technician?
Exactly. Mm. Most of the emphasis is on methodology, is on how to teach. The whole idea of rewards and punishment, and basically what you're trying to do is turn out skilled people who are skilled in the process of getting children to think in certain ways and ask certain questions that lead to predictable answers. And so basically the implication is that they are being taught to think, but they aren't. They're being taught to think in the way that some script has predetermined that they will think.
Some statisticians, for that matter.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah, exactly. It's not a content person, because a content person would know. But what we've done is we've reduced content in favor of the methodology.
And that doesn't produce problem solvers.
Well, consider that old adage that there are lies, damn
lies. You can't have problem solving if there aren't any problems.
Well, she goes on to say, listen to this. Now, this is something else she says, and what Betsy's telling us here. Now, she's asked a student asked her if he could say no, and she said, go ahead, as long as you give three reasons. And she says, best essay he has ever written, right? So she gave that student the freedom to think, right? And that student, you know, disagreed and came up with three reasons. She says, we have essay writing in 4th and 7th grade tests, but they are graded on structure, length, and mechanics, never on the ideas.
No.
And never is in bold print. Okay? So they're graded on how the structure, how pretty they look in terms of the structure, the length, the grammar and things of that nature, but never on the ideas that are expressed.
So if a kid theoretically wrote an essay and it was mechanically correct, of the proper length, and grammatically structured, it would not matter if his argument was on the impacts of what happened when the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor in 1836.
Right.
Nope. That's an idea.
That's just incidental stuff.
But how often has this happened?
If somebody points out you're wrong, you can look that up. That's not the important part.
But how often has this happened? Professor O'Brien, this paper that's due this next week, how long does it have to be?
How long should it be? Do you want my name on the top, on the bottom, on the left side, the right side?
Does that count the title page?
Big should the margins be? And basically what we're talking about is the issue of risk. I mean, students are taught, and they're good at it. I mean, we've done a great job. Mm. Students know where all the risks are. They know where all the minefields are. How long do you want it? Do you want it single-spaced or double-spaced? How big do you want the margins? Do you want my name at the top or at the bottom? Do you want the pages numbered in the middle or on the left side or the right side or the top or the bottom? Or where do you want them? And the point is that because that's what they lose credit for. And the fact of the matter is, none of it gets to the substance of the paper. The substance of the paper becomes incidental. It becomes a way to practice all of that stuff.
Right.
And that stuff becomes the education. And it's, I was just going to make a comment. I hate to do this, but this course on leadership that we're going to do, the last course we do in June is going to be on leadership. And one of the things I got to make is the inconsistency between leadership and what we're educating for. Because we're not educating for leadership, we're educating for followership. And Jefferson said that in 1782 with the in the notes on Virginia, 1781, when he talked about, you educate your leaders to lead, and then you educate everybody else to follow along. Mm. And that's stability. And that's what we do. And I you know, when we talk about leadership, I mean, when you get to a definition of leadership, which is, say, basically, a leader is a person who can conceptualize and perceive options before other people do. And a leader is a person who can bring the best out of the people he or she is leading. You know, and so ultimately what that means is leadership is not a process, the end product of which you control. If you're a real leader, what that means is you're unleashing the potential of other people. We don't want that. We don't want that. Because we don't know where that's going to go.
That has dramatic implications for a nation.
It does.
Yeah, and a civilization.
But that's the logical extension of what we say we are committed to. And we've never been willing to do it. We've been afraid, and I can understand why we're afraid to do it. I'm not being totally insensitive. I can understand why we're afraid to do it. But once Betsy tells this fifth grader that it's okay to say no, what happens if the principal finds out that she's giving kids permission to step out of line? You know what I'm saying?
Right.
I'm just that's a kind of an extreme example, but it's really not. You know, it's very disturbing because in the process of doing this, we're crushing all of this talent and all this creativity. We're crushing it. We're never letting what might be there blossom.
It's very depressing in a way. I mean, the other night, Thursday night, because we're way off the material, but Thursday night we had dinner with several members of the math department.
Oh my God!
Right? And that was an interesting. But they were lamenting, some of the things that they're encountering, even in terms of incoming freshmen as math students,
college,
an inability to basically.
We're talking about a Concord University class, and Concord University has admission standards, which means everybody who applies doesn't get in.
Yeah, exactly.
So basically, we're rejecting people. Mm-hmm. So these are people that pass muster of some kind.
Of some type.
And so Alan tells us that he gives a test and he gives a problem. 2 divided by 2 equals. And 4 people in his class said 2 divided by 2 is 2.
Yeah.
Now the question.
Well, it's probably a remedial class, I'd say.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. These are university level people that were admitted into a university on some sort of a competitive basis. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying to myself, there's somebody in India who has internet speed 10 times faster than mine, who's way beyond 2 divided by 2. Mm-hmm. and who knows very well that 2 divided by 2 is not 2. And we're still teaching that to university people.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and
we,
so...
But what are we doing?
Well, it's and I know that, you know, you gave exams this week. I gave exams this week, and it's... You know, sometimes you can spend a lot of time on material, and yet it doesn't seem to take, and they don't really seem to kind of want to think about it. But I was lamenting the other night, I was saying that essentially I no longer have the apex student. I no longer have the student who comes in especially a freshman level world civilization or American history class, and just, you know, does awesome on all the exams and writes wonderfully well thought out essays, and it, you know, there's no doubt
right.
about, you know, about the student's grade. That student, I don't have that student anymore.
That's kind of like with the NCAA in basketball with March Madness coming up. What all the people on ESPN are saying is that basically we've reached parity. There's any one of 15 different teams that can win the title mm-hmm. this year. And there's not a Kentucky or an Indiana,
right.
or there is an Indiana, but it's not. And what they're saying is there are a lot of good teams, but there aren't any great ones.
I mean, great team. I mean, I used to be, you'd have one or two students in a class, you know this, one or two students in a class that were just head and shoulders. They just,
right.
you know, those students are just not as evident anymore. I mean, you still have students who make A's, but not quite like that.
I mean, one of the things, this is not necessarily an effort to get back to the subject, but we want to do it.
Yeah, we definitely do.
But that's one of the things about American foreign policy that says we talked at the very beginning of the semester about the fact that colleges and universities and graduate schools are not looking at foreign policy as an entity in and of itself anymore. And basically, there is a position that suggests that these are the kinds of questions that we don't want our people to even know about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that, you know, for example, I mean, this particular strategic position that John Quincy Adams was able to successfully maneuver with the Monroe Doctrine is brilliant, but it's what Kissinger called realpolitik. It's the bottom line. It's what Machiavelli talked about. This is what you do. You can pretend you're doing all sorts of things. That doesn't matter. What matters is what you really do.
Realpolitik, as Kissinger's getting from Bismarck, that means power of reality.
Yeah,
the power of politics, a reality of power.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Adams accomplishes something tremendous considering the power that the United States possesses in the 1820s.
Right.
Right? So, I mean, that really is, you know, we should be, you know, I mean, you're praising his statesmanship. I am, too. I mean, there's no doubt about it. It's excellent. It's brilliant.
But he was reared from being a child. He was reared to assume this kind of leadership position.
Yeah, he was.
I mean, he was educated to be a leader. He was brought to Europe early on as a child.
Mm-hmm.
He was his father and mother are constantly talking about every opportunity. Don't let an opportunity pass to expose him to the kinds of situations mm-hmm. that he's going to be able to learn from. And how you do that with masses of, I mean, how do you do that with the masses of the people? And what
That's
we've done
question.
Is rather than try to figure out ways to do it, we've come up with an alternative to not have to do it, but continue to say we do it.
Mm.
And that's the scary part, because
right.
many people believe that actually what we're doing ought to work. And if it doesn't work, we blame the students on for it. And in reality, it's not totally their fault. I mean, I told you about this exam I gave. I don't want to go there, but, you know, I mean, and everybody took the same question because it looked to be the easiest, and in reality, it's the hardest. But if you redefine the question...
Right.
You know, and basically, I gave I won't keep this a mystery. I asked a question on an exam, and I said, pretend, it's a world history class. And I said, pretend that, it's 1750. You get up in the morning, and you go out, and there's standing in your front yard as an alien from another planet. And the alien says to you, I am on a mission. I'm to report back to my planet on the most important things or the most important people or the most important events or issues on your planet. What is the most important thing that's been going on that I ought to bring back about your planet?
Right. Where do I go to find out?
Where do I go? So the answers I'm getting are...
Now, they have to pretend it's 1750,
yeah.
right?
Okay. And so, the answers I'm getting are, well, that's an open-ended question, which means anything I say is okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe, one person said, I believe that, one of the people said, I would send them to Poor Rich's Almanac, because if you read a good, if you read a good newspaper, you can find out what's going on. And all I could think of, I didn't read this, but all I could think about is, well, you could say, go to a big city, and go to a house of prostitution near the ocean, because that's where the seamen goes, and the seamen have been around the world, so they'll know what's going on. It makes perfect sense. It's perfectly logical. And so I'm sitting here, and I'm looking at this. Now, how am I going to grade these?
Right.
Because basically the presumption is whatever I say is fine because it's mine. You asked for my opinion. I gave it to you.
Well, Bill, you could concentrate on structure, length, and mechanics if you liked. Sorry.
I've got something here, and Bill, you, I think, Keith, you're familiar too. Our friend Cassie, who's a junior at Princeton, came out of the public school system in Texas. Okay, nothing I say is going over that. I doubt if your mics can hear me. But Keith, I'm going to hand you this note I just got from Cassie.
All right, we have a comment from Cassie then.
Yeah,
right.
And it's the last sentence down here. That's going to make your hair catch fire and you're going to run around the room screaming.
Okay, Cassie has this to say, and some of us knew we were thinking on a different plane from our classmates. I learned how to think in middle school from... And the screen went off. What did I do here? Oh, I'm sorry. She learned how to think in middle school, and we'll get back to that in a moment. I learned how to think in middle school from teachers who ignored their district curriculum. They ignored it altogether.
Doesn't that tell you something?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
So in other words, we're dependent upon the future of America. For the future of this country, we are dependent upon teachers who are fearless enough to ignore the standards that upon which they depend in order to remain employed.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
That's not.
It's a little bit frightening. And, you know, and I mean, it fits here in terms of the foreign policy issue. And the reason that this is, I think, important, you know, I mean, it sounds like we're beating a dead horse. When we talk, for example, we talk about the sectionalism that existed between North and South prior to the Civil War and the extent to which North and South seem to be going in different directions. And all the things we've talked about surrounding the Monroe Doctrine suggest a direction that the nation is going to go in. But the more you talk about it and the more you penetrate it and engage it and think about it, the more you begin to realize that it's totally out of whack in terms of where the South is and where the South wants to go.
Right. Even though they believe in expansion.
Yeah. Their system.
Right.
Which is their way of blocking the other one.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about blocking the development. So in a sense, we're going in two different directions, and that's ultimately what the Civil War...
And leads eventually to conflict and creation and the Civil War.
And our two-party system can't fix it. On the contrary, it becomes a prisoner of it.
Yeah.
The two parties become separated and split, and once you reach that point, then you got politicians on both sides getting elected for office based on how firm their stand is not to negotiate
not to compromise with the other side. Right.
And once you reach that on a whole system that's based on the principle of compromise, you can't work. And we're seeing that in Washington right now.
And the system fell apart in 1861.
It did, and that's what scares me.
And
now,
when you look at the way European historians approach the American Civil War in particular, they usually put it that way. The American system fell apart, right? It fell apart. And you got to remember, especially in Britain, they had been predicting that the United States would not last anyway, right? That it was against the general received knowledge, the notion that you could have representative government over such a large space. But we fall apart.
In the context of what we're talking about right now, the reason that all of this is important is because this is the kind, these options and these strategies, these are the kinds of things that never come out in never come up in a history class anywhere. I mean, you know, but the fact of the matter is that there aren't teachers out there who are steeped in the content that can even know that these issues are issues. So therefore, they never come up, and that's, unfortunately, I believe that's part of the plan.
There's an intention not for.
There's a fear.
Okay.
There's a fear of this. Because, you know, for example, And this is specifically where we are here.
Okay.
I was sharing with you today that I reading Herring's book.
Right. Okay.
About William Seward. And basically, once the South started to secede from the Union after Lincoln's election in 1860, Herring makes the point that Seward goes to Lincoln and basically said, if the United States were to declare war on England and France both at the same time, it would create such a national emergency mm-hmm. that it would bring the Union back together again. It would ensure that the Union stayed together. Mm-hmm. And Herring makes the point that Lincoln, you know,
wisely,
quietly said, you know, just go back and put a little bit more ice in your bourbon, you know. But the fact of the matter is that's an unbelievable piece of information.
Yeah.
And basically what it says a lot about Seward, mm-hmm. but it also says a lot about Seward that he would actually mention that to the president, mm-hmm. to President Lincoln, as an option. And basically what he's saying is the most horrible thing that could happen is that this nation will split. And so in order to keep that from happening, you do what you have to do.
Right.
You declare war on the other people. Mm-hmm. And so how many times have you heard the argument that that things like Vietnam and all of that had political ramifications, mm-hmm. that as the Watergate, you know, for example, in the 70s, as in the late 60s and early 70s, as Watergate was beginning to become more and more public, as more and more people were beginning to hear and learn about what went on in Watergate, the Nixon administration consciously decided we really have to escalate Vietnam in order to take people's attention away from
the distraction.
Watergate. And so foreign policy becomes a strategy to divert people's attention from domestic policy, mm-hmm. which is what they vote on.
Interesting, yeah.
You know, and so, and you begin to, and is it something that we would need to fear that students at a high school level or even at a junior high school level would become aware that these kinds of issues and these kinds of strategies are on the table when nations are making foreign policy decisions and determinations? I don't know. You know?
But it's kind of interesting. You can interpret the Civil War in this era, and especially the Union War effort and Lincoln, as being part of a larger trend in Western civilization of, again, the triumph of nationalism that Napoleon had unleashed. And you think about Germany unifies through the three wars of German unification under Bismarck and Cavour in Italy and the Italian wars of unification. In a sense, the United States becomes a nation out of the Civil War, right? Mm-hmm. We go from this division, we become a nation, and part of Reconstruction is trying to rebuild that half
of
the nation.
Just to build it, yeah.
You can interpret it, and I noticed, like, world history textbooks, college level world history textbooks, often interpret the Civil War in that kind of light. But I've noticed that I can talk about Bismarck and all the things Bismarck does in Germany to maneuver a public opinion and to maneuver nations into war and all of those things, and students generally will think that is just so repulsive, that. He basically plays politics with people's lives in a realpolitik sense. But you can talk about things that the Lincoln administration does, and it's just smart.
Yeah. It's
kind of a different, you apply a different standard of evaluation depending on who you're talking about. They're Germans, so it obviously can't be the same kind of thing as what we're dealing with.
And so ultimately what we're dealing with is the real world, which is the idealistic world.
I had a student years ago, I know I told you about this, I was doing a lecture on German unification, 102, and I was finished, and she came up to me and she said, I never knew anything else was going on when the American Civil War was taking place. You know, and the whole world was just sitting by idly, you know, while Lee and Grant were battling it out in the wilderness.
Right.
Nothing else was happening in the world. There's a tendency in terms of teaching American history not to take the world into account,
no.
not to think about what's going on. I mean, That's going on in Germany in the 1860s. In 1862, Bismarck becomes the Chancellor of Germany. You know, that's what's happening there. The revolutions of 1848 have an impact on the Civil War. A lot of the men in the Union Army who spoke German showed up because they left Europe during the revolutions of 1848. Yeah. And so all these things come together. We can't see, you know, can't just see, you know, our particular section, I guess you might say, in complete isolation. But that doesn't fit the way that we kind of set things up. This is American history. And so, therefore, this is all we'll talk about, is the history of this particular area. Right?
Well, I thought it was interesting that we had, if you look at the foreign policy surrounding the Civil War, for example, mm-hmm. an awful lot of people don't know that there is a foreign policy.
Yeah.
As you say, yeah. Everybody assumes that the world stopped and waited right. until our Civil War was over.
It's an international event in many ways. Yeah.
But you can't understand the turnout, the volunteer turnout of Lincoln's call-up of troops. You cannot understand that coming from the upper Midwest unless you understand the migratory patterns that followed
exactly.
from the Revolution of 1848. Mm-hmm. The large German population in New York. But you also had them in Illinois, Indiana, Wisconsin, mm-hmm. Iowa, Minnesota, all of those states for whom there are monuments down at Shiloh.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's Grant's Western Army.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's the army that marched with Sherman to the sea yeah. and gave Grant the victories that he needed to ultimately be put in charge of the Army of the Potomac.
So without the Revolution of 1848, or some basic grasp of it, all that immigration and how that played into the Union war effort, and also in terms of how they view the very concept of union and how they view the Constitution. The Civil War has an ideological impact.
And in the way that the Revolution of 1848 was suppressed,
mm-hmm. All right.
and the forces that did the suppression, you know, those conservative forces you were talking about right. earlier, if you're a German emigre farmer in Minnesota or Wisconsin, it's going to be easy to draw a parallel between the Southern aristocracy's conservatism
exactly.
and
exactly.
conservatism.
That's right.
Exactly.
That's right.
And so when you look especially at how Europe views the Civil War, I think one thing that you see consistently, and I don't care where it's at, is generally speaking, Prussia, for example, we've been talking about Germany. In Prussia, the nobility, the Junkers, view the Southern planter class as they identify with that Southern planter class. The King of Prussia doesn't. In a sense, the King of Prussia will support the Union because he sees it as a revolution against constituted authority. Surprise, surprise, his younger brother experienced the Revolution of 1848, or his older brother, rather. Surprised that he would see it as a revolution, he would interpret it in that context. But generally speaking, European nobilities, you know, tend to support the Confederacy, pull for the Confederacy, because they see the Confederacy as a society that's very similar to their own, of landed aristocrats.
Mm-hmm.
In Britain, the Tories, the Conservatives, they prefer the Confederacy. They would like to aid the Confederacy in some way. They see the Confederacy as representing a society of aristocrats. They also see the Confederacy, if it is successful, as being something that will basically undermine what they see as the nasty example of the United States. Too much liberalism, too much voice in government. They want to see restrictions, more restrictions. They don't want to see expansion. And so the United States is an example that, you know, they would like to see kind of topple at this particular point. Whereas Whigs, liberals, in the House of Commons, will support the idea of supporting the Union. They would prefer to see the Union prevail in the Civil War. And so there's conflict within Parliament over the American Civil War. And that conflict, I would argue, is very important in terms of the outcome of the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we tend to ignore the diplomacy aspect of the Civil War. Most of the books, I mean, there were 60,000 books, or 600,000, sorry, books in print on the American Civil War. The vast majority are on generals and battles and campaigns and things of that nature. There are very few good books on Civil War diplomacy. It doesn't attract as much attention. It's not as exciting or as dramatic. But just as the young United States in the American Revolution desperately needed the recognition and aid of France, the Confederacy desperately needed the recognition of Great Britain and aid. They needed that in order to prevail.
If the South's foreign policy expectations or hopes had been successful, it's not clear that the war would have ended the way it ended.
No.
It really is not clear at all. Because Lincoln was adamant in denying the right of the Southern states to secede anyway.
Right.
So his argument is they never had a right to go anyway.
Yeah.
It's rebellion. If legitimate nations throughout the world began to recognize the legitimacy of the Confederacy, then Lincoln could no longer make that case.
And one problem was,
it became a war between the United States and
the Confederacy. Is the Confederacy a nation?
Right.
That's the whole beef. When he places a blockade on the Confederacy, that creates somewhat of an issue, because a blockade is the type of
action that you use against a nation.
So you're treating the Confederacy like a nation.
Like a nation.
And Britain responded by extending to the Confederacy belligerent status. They did not recognize the Confederacy. They did not, give the Confederacy diplomatic relations, but they extended to the Confederacy the status of belligerents, which sets up for, the entire debate going on in Parliament. There's going to be, again, a section of the British government, and it's the Prime Minister, Lord Palmerston, certainly Lord Roberts and some of the other cabinet members are certainly going to be very favorable toward the Confederacy.
Uh-huh.
And so Union and Confederate diplomacy, I think, is very important in terms of the outcome.
Yeah.
But it rarely gets mentioned.
Yeah, right.
it usually doesn't get much attention, when actually it's probably vital in terms of the outcome of the war.
And once again, one of the key players in American foreign policy during this period is Charles Adams.
Charles Francis Adams.
I mean, the Adams family. it's just incredible.
Yeah.
That family's incredible.
Yeah, and he does an excellent job against some pretty formidable circumstances as minister.
And his dad was John Quincy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah,
and his son was Henry?
Henry.
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 So his
Adams,
son's Henry.
Yeah.
There's a
the education.
Yeah, the education of Henry Adams. So
yeah.
That family continued to have a lot of impact.
Well, incredible impact on.
Mm-hmm.
And they understood the world. They were raising their children to understand the world in order that they could lead this nation in it.
And so that's three generations of statesmen there in that one family. And especially in the case of John Quincy and Charles Francis, very, 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 very able diplomats. John Adams was a diplomat. He had his problems, but they very, very able in that sense. If you look at the policy objectives of the Union and the Confederacy, I mean, if you think about policy, what are their political objectives? If war is continuation of politics by another means, as Clausewitz puts it, what was their political objectives? That's pretty simple to understand. The Confederacy, of course, wanted independence. That's exactly the same goal as the United States in the American Revolution. That's why Jefferson Davis basically can portray them in many ways as being the same kind of movement, the true meaning of the Constitution, etc. The Union political objective was, of course, to preserve the Union. And so they had to do that by any means possible. As far as grand strategy was concerned, diplomacy certainly had to play a major role. I mean, the South had to try to get recognition, the North had to try to prevent that. And the goals of each side and how they pursue those goals is important. Obviously, one thing is going to inhibit the Confederacy, and if I could say there's one thing that prevents the Confederacy from gaining its objective, it's slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Slavery is crucial. I mean, Lord Lyons at the very beginning of the conflict, and by the way, there's a great book by Amanda Foreman, a huge book, I think called The World Ablaze or World of Fire or something like that, in which he looks at the British view of the American Civil War. And another book I definitely would want to point to here, especially to our participants, is this one by Dean Mahan, which is called One War at a Time. Right, and you can get this at Ollie's sometimes. In fact, there's the price tag. Right, you can get this at Ollie's in our area sometimes for $4.99. This, I think, is one of the best looks at the international dimensions of the American Civil War, and not just Britain and France, and of course France's attempts to intervene in Mexico, but also how Prussia and Austria and Russia and various parts of the world view the American Civil War and what kind of impact it had, and also very significant sections both on Union and Confederate diplomacy in terms of what they were trying to accomplish. But Lord Lyons, at the very beginning of the conflict, wrote back to his government. He's the British minister to America, to the United States, and said essentially, you know, slavery, talking about the South, slavery will condemn them, right? It will condemn them. I mean, the fact that they are, that's going to be, I think, the crucial factor. Because even though upper classes in Britain and the London Times, representing their interests very often, mm-hmm. Will praise the Confederacy, lionize the Confederacy, you know, write extensively about Lee's battlefield victories and things of that nature, the fundamental fact is that the British working class opposed slavery. And as a result, that means that the Emancipation Proclamation is a foreign policy document. It's as much a foreign policy document as anything else. It is as aimed at Britain and France as any other constituency, because Lincoln's finally moved to that point where he's ready to make that move and ready to make the war to some degree about emancipation. And when he does that, you have a very sharp change in Britain.
He solved the foreign policy problem.
Yeah, yeah. The reason why he was reluctant, obviously, is he's concerned about the border states. Mm-hmm. You're concerned about the border states, but by late 1862, he realizes that emancipation is a weapon in the Union arsenal that can be used against the Confederacy very effectively, and part of that is obviously diplomacy, because it's going to be harder and harder and harder for elements who support the Confederacy in Britain to reconcile their support with, obviously, you know, the fact that Britain had long ago, you know, abandoned slavery in its colonies everywhere, right? And were opponents, essentially, of slavery. So, in a sense, one thing that really works against the Confederacy is the fact that they are out of touch with the rest of the world,
yeah,
in that sense.
Yeah.
And part is also decisions that were made. If you look at Confederate diplomatic decisions, Davis seems to have underrated diplomacy at first. His inaugural address in February of 1861, which we were thinking about looking at, but it certainly has a foreign policy element to it. He's trying to blame the North for the coming of the war. He's trying to, of course, you know, make the North look responsible for any conflict that will take place. Of course, the fact that the Confederates fired Fort Sumter, you know, certainly puts a different light on that.
Yeah.
But the last thing they needed to do was emphasize slavery. But the first envoy that he sends to Britain is William Yancey, who's one of the most vocal supporters and defenders of slavery possible.
Right.
And so he spends all of his time talking about the glories of slavery, and that doesn't sit well with a lot of the British public.
Yeah.
James Murray Mason of Virginia, also, you know, seen as being, you know, this ultra-radical defender of slavery as well.
Does this reality of the fact that the South was so far out of touch with the rest of the world when it came to slavery, most of the rest of the world had moved beyond slavery,
yeah,
does that support the argument that many people make that slavery ultimately was going to die anyway, even if there hadn't been a war?
Hmm.
The fact that the whole world's against it. I mean, most people, when they talk about whether slavery was approaching its own end, will concentrate, focus primarily on what's going on within this country.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact of the matter is, if you look at it from a world perspective...
I'm sorry. The author of the book is Dean Mahan, M-A-H-I-N. I don't even know if I'm saying his name correctly, but... And it's Brassey's Inc., okay? In fact, the website for the publisher is Brassey, BrasseySeyinc.com. And again, especially those of our teachers, you can find this a lot of times at Ollie's.
Yeah.
And in fact, they used to have a bunch of them. I mean, it's not exactly flying off the shelves, right, because of the topic.
No, right.
And also, one thing, I think you're making a point in terms of, was slavery on the way out? It represented a massive investment, and the fact of the matter is, I think that the Confederacy, I'm presenting the view here that I believe the Confederacy was founded, the founders of the Confederacy were trying to protect the institution of slavery. I think they say that in their founding documents.
Mm-hmm.
I think they say it in the declarations of the causes of secession. I think they say it in the secession commissioner's speeches. I think they say it, for example, Stevens, the vice president, in his cornerstone speech. It's in the Constitution. I think they're very straightforward about that in 1860 and 1861. what creates problems, I especially see with my students here in southern West Virginia, where people generally support the Confederacy, is, you know, their great-great-great-great-grandfather, you know, did he fight for slavery? Well, probably not. All right? Probably not. He probably fought because he perceived that, you know, the place where he lives is being invaded. But the policymakers, the framers of the Confederacy, I think primarily had preservation of their class and preservation of slavery, therefore, as part of their political and economic power in mind. They're willing to fight over it. And if you read the secession commissioners' speeches, you know, they say things like, you know, they're willing to, you know, go down in flames and let the entire society perish rather than submit to degradation and all that they mean by that. So I don't know. I don't know if we can say that slavery was on the way to extinction, but it certainly was on its way to extinction in most of the world, except for America. That's for sure.
When you say, as you did pretty adamantly, that the Emancipation Proclamation is a foreign policy document,
mm-hmm.
obviously the Confederacy recognized that as
yes,
well.
Yes, they did.
Yeah.
Yes, they did. And so I think the Confederacy was a little late in understanding the value of diplomacy. They were convinced that King Cotton diplomacy, that in fact they burned like 2.5 million bales of cotton in 1861 in order to prevent that from becoming, in order to basically reduce the supply. They think that they could put enough economic pressure on Britain and France. I mean, Britain, about 80%, in 1860, about 80% of the cotton that's used for textiles in Britain comes from the American South. About 90% used in the French textile industry, it's much smaller, came from the American South. And they basically kind of adopt a program of economic blackmail to try to kind of persuade Britain and France to recognize and intervene. The British were not idiots. They were perceptive enough to understand that there was the possibility in India, etc. And so the British Empire provided other sources of cotton. But, you know, there was quite a bit of economic hardship in Britain as a result of the American Civil War. I'll also kind of point out one of the things that certain British interests did to kind of aid the Confederacy. The Confederacy has no navy, and especially if you think about the blockade. The problems of blockade can impose upon the Confederacy. They had no real navy to speak of, and so what they essentially did was they tried to develop ships, especially commerce raiders, and they often did this by clandestinely dealing with certain British companies, corporations, to build commerce raiders for them, build ships for them. And I tell you, a good book about this, since we're talking about that, would be this one by James Tertius Decay, The Rebel Raiders, The Astonishing History of the Confederacy's Secret Navy. Really good one. What they did is they sent agents, and their most effective agent to do this, Confederacy's agent, was James Bullock, who was a maternal uncle of Theodore Roosevelt. And Bullock essentially contracted with, especially the Laird Company, Laird Brothers, to basically develop these commerce raiders. And what would be the CSS Alabama is the most famous, right? Sam's in the CSS Alabama. And so the Confederacy is using commerce raiders actually fairly effectively, especially if you look at the Alabama. And so some of the documents we have, especially like the Sumner speech about the Alabama claims. In this book, since we're doing a lot of bibliography here, Wolf of the Deep by Stephen Fox, which is really a biography of Sam's in many ways, but it's Raphael Sam's and the notorious Confederate raider CSS Alabama. He has an interesting statement here in terms of statistics. One of the things, if you look at the Sumner speech, and I know we're out of time, and I'll kind of close with this, but if you look at the Sumner speech, is he puts forth a lot of statistics in terms of the impact of the Alabama and the other commerce raiders, the Shenandoah, the Florida, etc. But here's what Fox tells us in this what I think is a great book on this topic. He says, in 22 months and 75,000 miles of cruising, the Alabama burned 52 Union ships, sank one, bonded nine, and variously disposed of three others, 65 captures in all. By their own estimates, the men of the Alabama seized over $5 million worth of enemy shipping. Beyond those numbers, Sims had affected the Union blockade and Confederate morale, Union morale, Anglo-American relations, and the current future prospects of the U.S. merchant fleet. A few weeks after the Battle of Cherbourg, the New York World, Cherbourg is the battle in which the Kearsarge sinks to the CSS Alabama. at the end of its career. The New York World printed a list of over 900 Yankee ships sold into foreign hands, mainly British, since 1860. And you can kind of see why there's so much intensity in Sumner as a senator from Massachusetts. The British had built the ship, supposedly for a third party. It was not the Confederacy. And then they take the ship out to sea, and then you have the formal sale to the Confederacy. And the Confederacy uses it to sink Union merchant shipping, Northern merchant shipping. And the result is it has a dramatic impact on merchant shipping in the North. And many people are basically selling their ships to British interests in order to try to prevent seizure from Confederate raiders. And so they have a big impact on the economy in the North. And you can kind of see where, Sumner's so angry. Mm-hmm. Because those are Massachusetts shipmasters whose ships are being burned out there by the Alabama. Go ahead.
But if you understand the Confederacy the way Lincoln did, to the extent that the Confederacy is not a separate nation, Davis was president of nothing.
Right.
That there was no such thing as the Confederacy. It was merely a bunch of states in rebellion.
It's a rebellion.
We have to understand ships like the Alabama and people like Sims as nothing more
or pirates.
Than common pirates.
They're pirates. Mm-hmm. And which Sims, by the way, really, you want to make him angry. And very often captains would do this when he would capture a ship and then bring them on. He also, by the way, had a law degree, Sims did. And so he would kind of have this informal court which he would determine almost invariably that this is a proper contraband ship that he can burn. But if they were to say something about, call him a pirate or something, there'd be nothing that would inflame him more. But that's essentially, you can see where,
He knew he was.
Yeah, well, no, he didn't know he was. He didn't think he was, right? He thinks he's a privateer, right? He thinks there's a difference. Ironically, this is a good point, you might could argue he did know he was, because he writes a book during the Mexican-American War in which he denounces commerce raiding. Sims writes a book, he denounces commerce raiding. But he certainly has a change of mind when he's the guy actually doing it, right? But 900 ships.
How many times does that happen?
900 ships, actually are sold primarily to British interests. So it does have an impact. And that obviously increases the tensions between the United States and Britain. Probably the closest moment the British come close in 1862 to recognizing the Confederacy. Of course, the Trent Affair in 1861, in which a Union naval captain seizes Mason and Slidell, the Confederate envoys to Britain and France, off of a British ship, certainly creates an international incident in which Lincoln has to back down. Because if you don't, he's afraid. The Union essentially has to kind of walk a really, really fine line between compromise and not going to war with Great Britain, but yet talking tough and presenting a hard line. And that for the first 2 years of the war, that is very difficult. Mm-hmm. And with Lee's victories, especially in the Eastern Theater in 1862, it's difficult. But I think once you get the Emancipation Proclamation, I think that things change. It's very hard in Britain to continue to support the Confederacy in the House of Lords or what have you.
Yeah.
When slavery is constantly a part of it.
Is the issue.
Constantly a part of it. So I think it is a foreign policy document in many ways.
Well, you wasted all this time again.
Look at all that. Didn't say half
here we
what
are.
Say about that, but
here we are. I don't know if we covered foreign policy of the Civil War.
Well,
that's what we kind of
can pick up on that a little bit next time and maybe start thinking about American ascent in the 1890s.
In the late 19th century.
And that would give us a chance to talk about the open door policy, which I know you're interested in.
That's my bad, yeah.
Yeah, so we can talk about John Hay.
Yeah.
So
okay.
We appreciate everybody.
Thank you all very much. Thanks for the emails and the chat comments. Betsy and you folks out there, thank you so very much.
Mm-hmm. All right.
I guess we're done. So have a good day. Be safe. And we'll see you next time on a Prism Chat. Thank you.
Take care.